The public had the opportunity to pay their respects to former Montana First Lady Betty Babcock at the Capitol. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry talks about an upcoming race that supports a cancer community. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the University of California San Francisco professor who compares the tobacco industry to Godzilla. Flags continue flying at half staff today in honor of former Montana First Lady Betty Babcock. The wife of former Governor Tim Babcock died this past Sunday at age 91. A closed casket viewing was held in the Capitol Building's rotunda today for the public to pay respects. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us just how rare that is.
Former First Lady Betty Babcock's cedar casket lies draped in a Montana flag. It's cordoned off by a red rope hanging from waist-high silver posts. Two highway patrol troopers stand at attention looking north at the Capitol Building's main front doors, which are almost never open, but are wide open for this. People wander in and out, paying their respects. Shirley Herron is wearing all black, including a wide-brimmed black hat. She's president of the Montana Federation of Republican Women and says she's been close friends with Betty Babcock since the 1980s.
Oh, Betty is absolutely the dearest friend anybody could ever, ever wish for.
A selfless and caring personality, a strong advocate for causes she believed in, passage of the 1972 Montana Constitution, which she helped craft, a new building for the Montana Historical Society, and right here, the Capitol Building. Herron says the former First Lady was instrumental in pressing the legislature to pass a nearly $30 million renovation of the Capitol in the 90s.
Oh, absolutely. Betty was the driving force.
It's rare for anybody to lie in state in Montana's seat of public power. Former Governor Tom Judge's casket was given a public viewing after he died in 2006. That was in the old Supreme Court chambers on the third floor. The last time anyone lied in state in the main rotunda was in 1962, Governor Donald Nutter, who died in a plane crash after a year in office. His death moved Lieutenant Governor Tim Babcock into the governor's seat. Betty Babcock became First Lady. Chief Program and Information Officer at the Department of Administration, Cheryl Olson, says there isn't any specific policy or law on the books detailing what it takes to lie in state in the Capitol.
So in this situation, the family requested that Mrs. Babcock lie in state in the Capitol, and we were very pleased to honor that.
It was okayed by the Department of Administration and by the office of Governor Steve Bullock.
She was an incredible lady. I mean, that contributed so much. She was someone that stayed engaged in Montana all throughout her life.
Shirley Herron looks out over the ornate marble and green and red walls of the Capitol her friend helped restore. Seeing Betty Babcock's coffin draped in the state flag, she calls it a worthy tribute.
There couldn't be anything that would be more fitting than for her to be able to lie in state in the building that she absolutely was the key to having it renovated and brought back to, as she said, the grandeur that was put in this building when it opened up in 1902.
Betty Babcock's funeral is being held this Friday in Helena. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, six people who oversaw a Blackfeet program for troubled youth have been arraigned on charges they embezzled money from the $99.3 million project. They also are accused of doctoring invoices to embellish the tribal contributions needed to keep the federal money flowing to the now-defunct POCA project. Indictments kept under seal until today include former program leaders Francis Onstad and Delisle Shani Ogier. They appeared before U.S. Magistrate Judge Keith Strong in Great Falls, along with Gary Conti, who was the national monitor for the POCA project. Dorothy Still Smoking, a local evaluator for the project, Catherine Sherman, the project's former in-kind coordinator, and former administrative assistant Charlotte Newbrest. They face 37 criminal counts, including wire fraud, conspiracy to defraud the United States, and others. All six pleaded not guilty.
U.S. Senator John Tester and Governor Steve Bullock were stunned as they toured Gallatin County farmland damaged by a strong thunderstorm last week. Tester, a farmer from Big Sandy, said yesterday the damage from the August 1st storm made him sick to his stomach, while Bullock called the tour, quote, eye-opening and sickening, unquote. The county's Farm Service Agency Executive Director, Billy Dennison, gathered information Monday for county commissioners so they can ask Bullock to declare the county's agricultural land a disaster area. Dennison said most farmers saw 40% to 80% crop loss due to hail and winds that gusted up to 90 miles an hour. Bullock said there shouldn't be any question that a declaration is warranted. Such a declaration could trigger federally subsidized loans for affected farmers.
A red flag warning for thunderstorms in southwest Montana is currently in effect. The storms are expected to last throughout the next 4 days. National Weather Service meteorologist Dan Zumpf says thunderstorms are expected to have cloud-to-ground lightning, the type of lightning that starts fires and can spread existing ones. He says the fire community is getting prepared.
We're seeing, you know, hundreds or to thousands of lightning strikes, and with the conditions of our live and dead forest fuels, the trees, the logs laying on the ground, the grasses, they're all sitting in very dry conditions and are ready to ignite. We just need the lightning and then the gusty winds to fan those flames. So in these kind of situations, their preparedness goes up quite a bit.
For tomorrow, southwest Montana can expect drier thunderstorms. Then as storms move north, they will bring heavy rainfall on Saturday and Sunday.
West central Montana, including like Missoula and northward, there's a better chance that you'll actually get rain that will wet the ground and not just get dry lightning that will simply start fires. It'll be more of a mixed bag of wet and dry, or as we say, you know, very little rainfall type thunderstorms in west central Montana. But as you get up into northwest Montana, there should be a lot more rainfall with them, and there is some potential for heavy rain at this time.
The thunderstorms will remain south of Hamilton in the Bitterroot Valley, Butte area, and in Beaverhead, Madison, Ravalli, Missoula, and Silver Bow counties. We'll have more on weather later on in this broadcast.
U.S. District Judge Jack Shanstrom of Billings is announcing his retirement. The federal court said today that Shanstrom is stepping down September 15th. He has been working under senior status since 2001. Shanstrom was originally appointed in 1990 by former President George H.W. Bush. Prior to that, he was a magistrate judge for the district, state district court judge, and a county prosecutor. Shanstrom graduated Montana State University in 1957. The court said that Shanstrom has maintained a regular caseload since taking senior status. The U.S. Senate is currently considering two appointments to the federal bench in Montana. President Barack Obama has nominated District Judge Susan Waters and Montana Supreme Court Justice Brian Morris for the posts.
The U.S. Department of Labor is fining a petroleum refinery in Great Falls for unsafe working conditions. The agency's Occupational Safety and Health Administration said today it is proposing a $77,000 fine for Calumet Montana Refining. OSHA Area Director Jeff Funk of Billings says the company modified high-voltage electrical equipment to keep the asphalt mill operating despite safety concerns. Funk says it is unacceptable to place production above safety. OSHA says an arc explosion occurred at the mill in February. Inspectors said a switch was blocked with insulating material, rendering a protector circuit inoperable. The company has 15 days to comply or contest the charge or fine. Calumet did not immediately return a call seeking comment.
A coroner's inquest is scheduled next week to examine the February shooting death of a 32-year-old Billings man by a police officer. Jason James Shaw was shot in the abdomen by Officer Grant Morrison on February 11th. The Billings Gazette reports Bighorn County Coroner Terry Bullis will preside over the hearing, which starts Tuesday. Police accounts say Morrison encountered Shaw and three others in a car as officers were searching for a person who ran from police. Shaw got out of the car and refused to follow officers' instructions. The police report says Morrison tried unsuccessfully to subdue Shaw with a stun gun. Morrison said Shaw then reached into his pocket for a handgun and Morrison shot Shaw. Shaw's gun was a BB gun replica of a law enforcement handgun.
Flathead Lake runs nearly the length of a marathon from Polson to Summers. A race this weekend will see canoes, kayakers, and other paddle sports enthusiasts traveling the length from south to north. Katrin Fry reports the race will benefit a nonprofit organization committed to serving a cancer community its founder says often gets overlooked.
Founder of First Descents, Brad Ludden, says his organization offers free outdoor adventure camps to people aged 18 to 39 who are battling cancer.
My aunt was diagnosed with breast cancer in her 30s, And it was a really traumatic experience for sure for me to see it, to watch her go through that and feel helpless. But I think what struck me even more was just that there was no support for her. She had no one to turn to, no one to call, no one to reach out to, and she felt very isolated in that experience. And her experience is unfortunately all too common amongst young adults who are diagnosed in the U.S.
Ludden says about 72,000 adults in that age range are diagnosed with cancer each year, and he says cure rates and five-year survival rates haven't increased much over the past 40 years.
Top that with the fact that these guys are facing arguably the largest challenges of their life, you know, things like raising a family, dating, finishing college, starting a new job. And you've got kind of a recipe for disaster.
First Descents offers multi-day whitewater kayaking, surfing, and rock climbing programs. Ludden says they use the programs as a platform for therapy to restore the psychosocial damage caused by the cancer diagnosis. He says the focus on whitewater comes out of his experience as a professional kayaker.
Being an athlete is a very self-centered profession. You're constantly promoting yourself and you get all of these great rewards. And I thought, I still think that kayaking can be one of the most therapeutic things that any of us could do. And so I thought, well, I'm in a position to recreate this for people like my aunt, who I saw suffering from cancer and really needing some sort of outlet and support.
Ludden says his aunt beat her cancer and was able to participate in one of First Descent's camps. First Descents will benefit from proceeds raised through the second epic shore-to-shore race on Flathead Lake this Saturday. The day features the 26-mile race from Polson to Summers, as well as a 10-mile and 5-mile solo race and a 4x2 relay for teams. The shorter races all start off in Summers. Ludden says he participated last year in the epic shore-to-shore and plans to participate in a different event this year.
I'm going to do kind of the other end of that spectrum and do the 5-mile stand-up paddle race. Probably in costume as well. The event itself is very much in line with our culture at First Descents. It's a legitimate challenge in a beautiful setting amongst friends, and that's really what we try to create for the participants and attendees at First Descents.
Those interested in participating can still sign up through the Epic Shore to Shore website, and those interested in the shorter races can also sign up on the day of the event. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Over 300 health professionals, advocates, and tobacco experts convened in Missoula this week for the 7th National Smokeless and Spit Tobacco Summit held at the University of Montana. The National Association of Chronic Disease Directors provided UM a $32,000 grant to plan the conference, which is devoted to addressing health and social issues connected to smokeless tobacco use. In this interview with Edward O'Brien, University of California San Francisco Department of Medicine Associate Professor Dr. Pamela Ling discusses her research into cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. Ling points out overall cigarette use is actually declining among young people.
And the rates of smokeless tobacco use are pretty much staying the same. Overall, the prevalence is about 2% of youth in the U.S. are using smokeless tobacco. But when you look at specific communities, you can see there's a wide variation.
I'm assuming more rural communities have a higher use. I have no idea if that's accurate.
You're absolutely right. So rural communities. So there's a big difference by gender. So teenage boys use smokeless tobacco much more so than girls. And then when you look at rural communities or the rural states, there are much higher rates of use than in other places.
Why is that?
I think it's in part because there's sort of a tradition of using smokeless tobacco in people who had rural work, and that also was really enhanced by really aggressive marketing by tobacco companies where they promoted smokeless tobacco products, you know, as something to be used by people who have rural jobs, where jobs where you use your hands, and also using sports that are popular in those communities.
And you say the tobacco companies really haven't done much to diminish their advertising of smokeless tobacco products?
Right. The smokeless tobacco advertising has really increased really dramatically over the past 20 years. So sales have gone up, and the amount of money spent on smokeless tobacco marketing has gone up tremendously over the past 20 years.
I thought that was verboten after the 98 agreement.
So advertising is not forbidden after the 1998 Master Settlement Agreement. The smokeless tobacco companies actually signed a separate agreement from the cigarette companies, and so they were allowed to do some things that the cigarette companies weren't allowed to do. And there are no limits on how much the companies can spend. There are limits on certain kinds of things they can or can't do.
What is the most common form of advertising for smokeless tobacco products right now?
I think the most of the money spent on marketing and advertising smokeless tobacco products is spent on price discounts. So it's actually spent making the product cheaper, either through coupons or through discounting in the stores. So most of the money is spent on that. But we still do see quite a bit of print advertising for smokeless tobacco in magazines, and we see a lot of online advertising and direct mail.
Joe Camel-esque types of advertising, subtle, or is it a little more just upfront?
I don't know if you would say Joe Camel was subtle, but the advertising is very appealing to young people. They also do a lot of really kind of masculine messaging, saying, you know, we're telling you like it is. And the advertising really embodies kind of an attitude, which they like to associate with smokeless tobacco, which is masculine, freedom, you know, men's men. And a lot of the advertising really emphasizes that. The other main message you get in the advertising is around price. So they do, you do a lot of things to make the products cheaper or offer like sweepstakes or special deals to make the product more enticing.
It's tough to make it enticing. When I was a kid, I tried it once. One time with a bunch of other idiot little boys, and that's all I needed. It was awful. I never did it again. What is the appeal? And I guess you just explained that. That would be the machismo, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that they really do. The companies do capitalize on that machismo. And they almost make, I mean, it's kind of a well-known fact that the first time you try smokeless tobacco, you're going to get really sick and your friends are all going to laugh at you. But it's, you know, when you want to then use that as a challenge to get good at it and use it more, and then, you know, get your next novice friend to get sick and laugh at him, that's the kind of dynamic that they like to support.
Good. The title of your presentation today was Resurrecting Godzilla, Transforming the Fight Against Smokeless Tobacco. Resurrecting Godzilla.
So Godzilla was meant to be a metaphor for the tobacco industry, which wreaks incredible destruction and is really resistant to a lot of traditional weapons. And wreaks destruction and then goes underground for a while or goes to the bottom of the ocean and everyone thinks it's not a big deal. I think around smokeless tobacco, there's a lot of messaging out there right now telling us that it's safer than cigarettes and it's not to be worried about. And that's really just not the case.
So what do you do? What is this counterfight?
Well, I think we have basically two weapons to fight against the tobacco industry. And one is we do have research, we do have data that shows that a lot of things they're doing appeal to youth and could be stopped. And then we also have our stories. And I think having people who have experience with smokeless tobacco and know about the kinds of harms that it causes to them can tell their stories, and those are two things that really do help fight against this misdirection from the tobacco industry.
And the harm is what? Oral cancers, things like that?
The most common health effect of smokeless tobacco use is changes in your mouth, leukoplakia, which can lead to oral cancer. It's also associated with cancers of the esophagus and the pancreas.
And your area of specialty is immense on this topic. I did notice one aspect, counter-marketing cigarette use, I believe, in bars in the Bay Area. Is that right?
Yeah, so a separate project that we have is, again, because I'm interested in marketing and counter-marketing, we're doing a project that focuses on young adult cigarette smokers. And we're basically working in bars because that's where the smokers are. And we're doing campaigns that are designed to counter the industry marketing that takes place in bars and nightclubs that means link together smoking with drinking and young adult social life. We have some research that's developing anti-tobacco brands and promoting them in bars and clubs to reinforce a smoke-free lifestyle.
Meaning what? E-cigs? Something like that?
Actually, no, tobacco-free is the message. So the message is that we have either highlight for the alternative music scene that being part of this scene is not about supporting an industry that contributes to world hunger and social justice issues, or the messaging can be about that it's actually more attractive and more sexy to be smoke-free and really promoting a positive image of people who don't use tobacco.
This is also an industry that contributes billions of dollars to the economy of the United States of America, yeah?
This is an industry that contributes money to the economy, but also costs the economy incredible amounts in terms of the health effects and the costs of medical costs related to tobacco. On balance, the tobacco control program in California has saved the state billions. It's cost millions of dollars, but has saved the state billions of dollars in health care costs.
Interesting. Do you see this issue one day going into the marijuana use?
I think the marijuana issue is interesting. I think there is more marketing, particularly around the e-cigarettes, actually, that seems to cross the line into marijuana use, because people often use these electronic devices and vaporizers to use marijuana in addition to nicotine. So I do think in terms of the marketing, there are some places where there may be some crossover. We also know when you talk to young people in California and you talk about smoking, they will always say, smoking what? Because they don't know if you're talking about tobacco or marijuana. And I think there does need to be more research on the links between multiple substance use.
Dr. Pamela Ling, Associate Professor in Residence at the University of California, San Francisco, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight I expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the 80s. For central Montana, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the lower 50s. Tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Highs will be in the upper 70s. And for southwest Montana, tonight look for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow calls for an increase in clouds with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be around 75 to 85 degrees. Currently in our listening area, Helena is 85 degrees with fair conditions. In Kalispell, it's sunny and 83 degrees. Butte has 82 degrees under stormy skies. Great Falls is sunny with 81 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature is partly cloudy skies with 88 degrees. It's 81 and partly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's partly cloudy and 87 degrees. Libby has 85 degrees under sunny conditions. And in Polson, skies are fair and it's 88 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dave Ditloff.
The signs of climate change are all around us. 2012 is the hottest year on record in the country. Last October, Superstorm Sandy wreaked havoc on the nation's largest city, and the Southwest has locked in another severe drought this summer. Here in Montana, it's hard to travel on any mountain highway and not notice the large swaths of beetle-killed forests, and we've had evening fishing closures kick in for a time as early as July this year. The planet is warming, and extreme weather events are becoming more common. Despite what some conservative pundits might tell you, the science is clear on this. A recent analysis of peer-reviewed scientific literature showed that 97% of articles related to climate change supported the concept that human-created carbon emissions are altering the Earth's climate. Citing a, quote, moral obligation to leave our children a planet that's not polluted or damaged, unquote, President Obama recently released a plan to cut carbon pollution. The cornerstone of the plan involves using his authority under the Clean Air Act to cut carbon emissions at new and existing power plants. Other components of the plan include improving efficiency standards in federal buildings, permitting wind and solar projects on public lands, developing fuel economy standards for heavy-duty trucks, and taking a leadership role in international efforts to address climate change. President Obama's plan is not perfect. The most effective and efficient way to cut carbon emissions would be to put a price on carbon through a cap-and-trade system or a carbon tax. But it would take new legislation to enable this sort of fix, and lately Congress has shown an inability to even have a reasoned discussion on climate change, much less actually pass a law that addresses the problem in any sort of comprehensive way. Given this fact, and the limited authority President Obama has to deal with the issue, his plan is actually pretty comprehensive in its scope. It deserves our support. Unfortunately, the plan's release was met with a great deal of bluster in Congress, especially among Republicans. House Speaker John Boehner tweeted, quote, Obama administration says we need a war on American energy, unquote. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell called the plan, quote, unilateral economic surrender, unquote. Even Montana's own Congressman Steve Daines stated, quote, with these policies, President Obama's commitment to waging war on American energy has been made clear, unquote. The most likely scenario Congress would take to defeat the president's climate plan would be to defund the Environmental Protection Agency. The House Appropriations Committee's panel that oversees the EPA is already considering cutting $2.8 billion from the agency's 2014 budget and prohibiting the administration from spending on any rulemaking process that would cut carbon emissions from new or existing power plants. These types of comments and strategies don't reflect the attitudes of the American public. A recent bipartisan national poll found that two-thirds of registered voters are in favor of establishing strong limits on carbon emissions at existing power plants. The same poll showed that nearly half of Republican voters approved of it. Another sign of bipartisan support for action on climate change came in a recent op-ed that ran in the New York Times. In it, four former EPA administrators and four separate Republican presidential administrations publicly supported President Obama's climate plan. William Ruckelshaus from the Nixon and Reagan administrations, Lee Thomas from the Reagan administration, William Riley from the first George Bush administration, and Christine Todd Whitman from the George W. Bush administration wrote, quote, "We have a message that transcends political affiliation. The United States must move now to take substantive steps to curb climate change. President Obama's June Climate Action Plan lays out achievable actions that would deliver real progress. Rather than argue against his proposals, our leaders in Congress should endorse them and start the overdue debate about what bigger steps are needed and how to achieve them." Action addressing climate change shouldn't spark controversy. Making sure we don't drastically alter our planet's climate seems like common sense. The well-being of our grandkids depends on it. What we do now regarding carbon emissions will impact the ecological sustainability, agricultural productivity, public health, and economic systems of generations to come. These aren't partisan issues. The economy will not collapse if President Obama's plan is implemented. These types of alarm calls are shouted out every time the EPA works to cut carbon emissions of harmful substances, whether it was cutting lead to protect human health, or sulfur dioxide to reduce acid rain, or chlorofluorocarbons to address holes in the ozone layer. Not once was there a significant economic problem as a result of the EPA regulations. In fact, most studies show that the economic benefits of the EPA regulations far outweigh the economic costs. We've waited too many years for such non-arguments to delay us any longer. President Obama's climate plan sets us in the right direction. Congress should not hinder it. Please go to www.whitehouse.gov/contact and write the president expressing your support for his climate plan and asking him to move forward with it. This is Dave Ditloff, Regional Representative for the National Wildlife Federation. Have a good night.
Dave Ditloff is one of several commentators in Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.